Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Ms. Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella. And I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Mantle Cell Lymphoma Treatment Update. Right. And to start, I just want to let you all know how many people we have on the call today. We have over 130 participants, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We also have a number of international participants from Canada and Kenya, so it is a global call. We are delighted to have you all on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Ajay Gopal. And Dr. Gopal is Affiliate Investigator, Translational Science and Therapeutics Division, Medical Director of Clinical Research, Hematology Malignancies/Hematology, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center, Professor, Medical Oncology Division, University of Washington, School of Medicine, Stephen Hahn Petersdorf, MD, Endowed Chair in Cancer Care, UW Medicine. And Dr. Gopal will be discussing an overview of mantle cell lymphoma, treatment options for newly diagnosed, the importance of communicating with your healthcare team, including key questions to ask, as well as guidelines to prepare for telehealth/telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It is my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Gopal.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Nazarian. Thank you, Joni. Really appreciate the opportunity to speak, and thanks so much for Cancer Care. Cancer Care has been providing this service and others for decades now, and I'm just looking at your logo, over 80 years, my goodness gracious. That's very impressive. So thank you for the opportunity to speak about mantle cell lymphoma. I'm going to start just by giving kind of a big picture overview of mantle cell, and I suspect there are many individuals with different levels of knowledge regarding mantle cell. So mantle cell lymphoma is one of the B-cell non-Hodgkin lymphomas. So this is a cancer of the lymphocytes, of the B lymphocytes, and it's a relatively rare one. Those of us at academic centers certainly see lots of individuals living with mantle cell, but in general, it's really only about 5% or so of all non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And that means there's less than, say, one per 100,000 diagnoses, 100,000 population per year. The median age of diagnosis is in the late 60s. And interestingly, and maybe we can talk about this a little bit later, but we don't completely understand, but it's about 80% male. It tends to be more of a Caucasian population. And the way individuals find out they have this diagnosis is extremely varied. It's very common that someone may undergo a colonoscopy, routine screening colonoscopy, and find a polyp, and this polyp might show mantle cell lymphoma since it likes to involve the gastrointestinal tract. Sometimes an abnormal blood count with an elevated lymphocyte count might diagnose mantle cell lymphoma. And then sometimes the more common presentation is enlargement of lymph nodes or spleen, which might be a way that mantle cell lymphoma shows up. We make the diagnosis under the microscope. We look for a specific chromosomal translocation, which leads to overexpression of cyclin D1. This can be also part of the diagnosis. And there's another marker called SOX11, which is also expressed commonly on mantle cell lymphoma. They also have typical B-cell markers such as CD20. And then CD5 is also a mantle cell marker, but can also be associated with CLL. So that's how we make the diagnosis of mantle cell lymphoma. And when we make the diagnosis, the question often is both prognosis and treatment. First, I'll say the prognostic scales are mostly useful in populations, and it's very difficult to apply them to an individual. So I would just caution one, if one goes looks up the Mantle Cell International Prognostic Index, or MIPI, to try to apply that to one person or individual. It does not predict how one's going to do. It's also based on historical data. So to understand these prognostic scales, these are reflecting therapies that we had 5 to 10 years ago or more, and not reflecting the options that we have in our hands today. So I would expect the outcomes to be better at all levels of prognosis with more tools that you'll hear about in this presentation. So then the question comes up, what about treatment options? And the first question that comes up in the clinic when I see someone with mantle cell lymphoma is, do we need to treat at all? And there are certainly data about initial observation for mantle cell lymphoma. There have been a number of studies. An early one was out of Cornell. There have been a separate one out of British Columbia Cancer Agency, and more recently a paper out of Memorial Sloan Kettering looking at this. And folks that are asymptomatic, it's clearly safe to observe these patients. And these tend to be folks that have a very low, there's this thing called Ki-67, which tells us how fast the cells are dividing. They tend to be more of the leukemic kind, so it's more in the blood and less in the lymph nodes, and often will not have this marker of SOX11 expression. So in these studies, the average duration of observation is approaching 2 years, and those that are observed. So this does provide a very safe option, has not shown to be detrimental in the long run for selected individuals. So first, that's the first thing. So for those that do need treatment due to symptoms or low blood counts or other concerns, the field has really dramatically changed, and I think this is very much, it's made it much more complicated in terms of decision making, but it's made it complicated in a good way. And, you know, I will just try to hit some of the major advances that we've seen in terms of understanding the first line therapy. So first, we have therapies that you'll hear about for relapsed or refractory mantle cell lymphoma are getting brought earlier to the front line, so this, such as drugs called Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors, BTK inhibitors. There have been large trials comparing treatment with or without a BTK inhibitor, which in general have shown improvements in outcome by using a Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Early studies were with ibrutinib, more recently studies with acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib. There have also been studies looking at whether there is a reason to do this thing called an autologous stem cell transplant in first remission. So the two largest studies that are quoted, one is a study called the Triangle Trial, and this was a trial comparing the use of ibrutinib with chemotherapy with chemotherapy plus rituximab, at with or without an autologous transplant. So some people got ibrutinib, some people got autologous transplant, some people got all of the above, and it did not appear that doing an autologous transplant was beneficial. It was fairly equivalent to giving this ibrutinib in terms of how long the remissions lasted. So that has really made us temper our enthusiasm for putting folks through this very intensive therapy of autologous transplant. Now, the question might be, who benefits the most or who benefits the least if you're going to do an autologous transplant? And this was a study addressed in an ECOG Akron study, 4151, and this was a study that looked at folks that got into a remission and then checked to see if they were in a molecular, a very deep, what we call MRD negative remission. And in that case, folks were randomly assigned to getting a transplant or not. And for folks, and what we learned was that if you are in an MRD negative first remission, adding an autologous transplant did not appear to improve overall survival. So I think this is actually a good thing to know, that we have approaches to both figure out who benefits and maybe offer alternative strategies other than this very intensive autologous transplant to result in better outcomes. And as you'll hear, part of this is also driven by the fact that, unlike in the past, we have many more downstream options for folks that need it, whereas in days gone by, we didn't have a lot of options, so we kind of threw the kitchen sink with an autologous transplant as our first therapy. So how do we decide what first therapy to give? And, you know, obviously this is, the trials are not giving, do not have all the various comparisons head to head, but some of the things we think about are, there's a particular molecular test called TP53, and if that mutation is present, we often think that the lymphoma, the mantle cell, will be less responsive to chemotherapy, and we might choose a trial that at least contains a regimen that contains a BTK inhibitor, or maybe we will do a chemo-free regimen, such as this regimen called Bovin, which has venetoclax, zanubrutinib, and obinutuzumab. So that might be a consideration. We also look at the proliferation, and if something is highly proliferative, dividing quickly, there are data to say that at least in terms of getting rapid disease control, chemotherapy can be helpful. We also take into consideration how fit a patient is and what other medical problems they might have, and certainly their preferences, and that may guide us to a more or less intensive first-line regimen. So these are some of the major changes, and if you sort of think about the guidelines now versus 5 or 10 years ago, there are many more options listed, and it does lead to a very long conversation and an individualization for the first-line treatment for mantle cell lymphoma, all of which are better than what we had in the past. One other thing that comes up in terms of initial therapy is maintenance therapy, and for the most part, most trials have shown a benefit of rituximab maintenance after initial therapy, and some trials have also looked at a fixed duration of BTK inhibitor maintenance as well. And I think the BTK inhibitor, we maybe can talk about in the Q&A a little bit about whether or not one wants to go continue that and get the most mileage initially, or you do it as a fixed duration and save it to be reused down the road if needed. So I'm going to pivot a little bit now and kind of build on what I said and talk about the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. And what I try to support in my patients is to really have transparency, bi-directional transparency with the healthcare team and patient and family about what the overall goals are, what the preferences are, and ask key questions about if there are options, what are the side effects? How many visits am I going to have? Because some regimens may require lots of visits. Some might even require being hospitalized for very intensive therapies or needing blood transfusions if we're giving very strong chemotherapy. And others that require oral therapies, it's good to ask questions about what might my copay be if I use this regimen that has a pill that might be an out-of-pocket copay. So really just being transparent about goals of care. And I think also asking about clinical trials, because the way we got to where we are now with better therapies was based on clinical trials. And we want to make data-driven recommendations to our patients, knowing that A is better than B or B is better than C. So being part of clinical trials is really very important in terms of improving both individual patients' outcome as well as future patients. Okay, so part of what we do nowadays, certainly post-COVID, is we do a lot more telehealth. In terms of preparing for telehealth, I mean, just practical tips, which I think may be obvious, is you might want to practice and make sure you can do Zoom or whatever platform works, what your healthcare provider uses. You want to make sure that you're in a good, quiet location. You've got good internet connection, no backlighting. Try to, you know, minimize dogs barking or whatever. But I will say, what I love about telehealth is almost like making a house call. So I kind of really like telehealth because you get to kind of really understand what a patient's home situation might be like. And it's really ideal to have all the participants be on camera because it really lends to a better discussion, kind of like in a clinic visit. So if folks are off, at least my personal preference, if people are off camera and I'm just hearing voices coming in, I kind of don't know who's talking. So I really love to have all the participants sort of be on camera. Of course, it's great to start promptly, and then having a list of questions ahead of time written down is really helps facilitate making sure that you get the most out of any telehealth visit. The final thing I'm going to touch on is the open notes, and this I believe is referring to the AI scribes. As you know, AI is penetrating all of our lives, but we're trying to use in medicine to make it more efficient so we can spend more time actually answering questions and counseling our patients and making important treatment decisions together with our patients and less time on paperwork. And these open notes and AI scribes can help reduce the administrative load on physicians so that we can really provide better care for our patients. I will say that both humans and AI are imperfect, and sometimes there can be errors that creep in to open notes. So I would just, you know, in terms of keeping that in mind, we do try to review and edit these, but sometimes these things can creep in. So please have some, I would request from an MD perspective, give us some grace there that we're trying to obviously do our best always for our patients. So with that, I'm going to probably conclude my presentation here, but just say it's certainly a very exciting time thinking about when I started my training. Mantle cell lymphoma in the late 90s was first really being described and understood as a separate entity, and how far we've come and how much the outcomes have improved for our patients who are living with this diagnosis. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Goldberg. And our next speaker is Dr. Thomas Haberman. And Dr. Haberman is Professor of Medicine, Hematology, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and Science. And Dr. Haberman will be discussing treatment options for relapse/refractory disease, clinical trials, and emerging treatment approaches, as well as quality of life concerns. Now, my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Haberman.
Thank you, Johnny. It's a real privilege to be here on with you and with Cancer Care with Ajay Gopal, who is very articulate and who I genuinely respect, and Nikki Malfatas. As a disclosure, I do have a tendency to use first names. So what are the treatment options for relapse refractory disease? The first observation I want to make is the following, that provide information and I think remarkable hope and are evidence for the hope. We're reporting on the event-free survival at 24 months with mantle cell lymphoma, which means you've not relapsed, you have not been retreated, you have no unplanned retreatment and are alive. We looked at 3,179 total patients throughout their course from 5 cohorts. We looked at two eras assessed from 2002 to 2020, so not the last 6 years. In the earlier era, 5-year lymphoma versus non-lymphoma mortality rate was 18% versus 8%. But in the contemporary era, it's essentially the same, 8% and 9%. And the post-event-free survival at 24 months, survival rates approached that of the general population in the United States from 12 center cohorts when compared with the age and sex match population. So achieving an EFS-24 in mantle cell lymphoma is associated with improved conditional survival, approaching that of the general population. And there was a declining lymphoma-related mortality in the era of contemporary immunochemotherapy. Patients do relapse from upfront treatment. So what are the present approaches? We've established our guidelines, which we put together in May of last year. And our present approach is that if you're a Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitor naive or sensitive, then you would get treated with one of the newer ones that have less toxicity, acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib. Then, as Ajay mentioned, if TP53 mutated, there's a difference in the outcomes. So considering adding venetoclax, or if other high-risk features which were mentioned, blastoid, pleomorphic morphology, that Ki-67 over 30%, or bulky disease, then one could consider a CAR T-cell early. If refractory to that BTK inhibitor approach, and if patients are CAR T eligible, there are now two CAR T preparations that are approved by the FDA and approved at the NCCN guideline level that are Brexacel or Lysacel. If patients are CAR T ineligible, then pirtobrutinib, another BTK inhibitor, or glofitamab are potential options. After that, then we still have a number of things that can be done, either the glofitamab or venetoclax, and I'm going to talk about another drug in just a moment, could be lenalidomide-based immunochemotherapy. I was the first author of the first lenalidomide paper in the British Journal in 2009, and now we add rituximab to it. Allo-stem cell transplant is also a possibility. We've just talked about auto, but allo is. And then there are other potential approaches in clinical trials. The outcomes at the beginning of relapse are superior if acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib are administered earlier. Pirtobrutinib is a reversible non-covalent BTK inhibitor, so there's kind of a constant exposure of the cells. And very fascinating, and to show you how the world keeps changing quickly, on May 13th of 2026, the FDA approved sonrotoclax, a BCL-2 inhibitor, so that's a cousin of venetoclax, and that was approved for relapse refractory mantle cell lymphoma after at least two lines of systemic therapy, which would include a BTK inhibitor. What's really been transformative in other certain ways across the field of lymphoma are the T-cell redirected therapeutic interventions, and it's within the context of time, we won't go through the details of what they're about, but CAR T-cell therapies, bispecific antibodies, now glofitamab with obinutuzumab at a dose of 2,000 milligrams, that's a relative of rituximab, produce very significant overall response rates, as does mosunetuzumab with polatuzumab with very similar overall response rates. Allogeneic transplant has been studied for a number of decades, and that we really aren't resorting to nearly the way we used to. So I've been a member of the NCCN Guideline B-Cell Committee for over 11 years, and I became very much a believer in that process. And essentially, this is in the United States, is what the third-party carriers rely on, what comes out. And what I've just talked about, the second-line therapy, acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib, and then lenalidomide, rituximab are there. And then I won't go through the others that I've just discussed. I do want to say one word for those of you who are involved in this disease about the TP53 mutations, and we tried to make a direct statement about this in the October 2025 publication from the NCCN guidelines, and made the statement that TP53 sequencing is an essential prognostic test. Most of the time that's available now, or people can be sent into referral labs, and there are conflicting reports if we only use what's called immunohistochemistry as a surrogate marker on the slides. So what about clinical trials and emerging treatment approaches? For relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma, some notable ongoing trials include the following. For BTK-naive patients, which there are now less, but pirtobrutinib versus investigator choice is fully enrolled, and the readout we are waiting for. Zanubrutinib plus sonrotoclax or placebo is now enrolling. So that drug was just approved, as I mentioned. So that's going to be a very important readout. For those patients who are BTK exposed, we now have BTK degraders as single agents that are being evaluated. We secondly have bispecific antibodies, which glofitamab is being evaluated versus investigator choice of bendamustine rituximab or lenalidomide rituximab. Number three, CAR T-cell therapy, different approaches are underway. There are combination trials, the BTK degrader plus glofitamab, pirtobrutinib plus glofitamab and tafasitamab, lenalidomide, venetoclax, and then there are also new targets. It's unfortunately a tremendous array of therapeutic approaches for those listening to all of this. But the neat thing is, Ajay just said, there's so much that we are doing and so much that can be done. So what are the emerging questions in the relapse refractory space? So the first question is how we're moving what BTK inhibitor up to frontline, and then should it be used in a time-limited fashion? Secondly, will CAR T be used earlier? We're looking at that in different lymphoproliferative disorders. So thirdly, pirtobrutinib and sonrotoclax, that's going to be, I think, a very interesting trial and a very fascinating approach. Number four, where did the bispecific antibodies fit in versus CAR T cell? And lastly, what is the best sequencing? CAR T, bispecific antibodies, pirtobrutinib, sonrotoclax. This is, we just heard, there are not a lot of mantle cell lymphoma patients around. And so to answer these questions takes an international effort and takes randomized studies that are very hard to do and expensive. So the last emerging point I'll just leave with you, this was a fascinating paper. We've been trying to look in our SPORE grant and LEO consortium and collaborations with others about lymphoid malignancy risk. When you all come in front of us as physicians, one of the earliest questions we get, why did I get this? And for the most part, we say to you, we don't know. Well, this was a case-controlled study of 6,990 cases of mantle cell lymphoma, 42,632 controls, and mantle cell lymphoma had the highest risk of any other lymphoid malignancy of having a genomic aberration. And in this study, TP53 was associated with a ninefold risk overall of a lymphoid malignancy, and TP53 was associated with an increased risk of mantle cell lymphoma. So what if we could find some of these early on before patients come in with the signs and symptoms that Ajay referred to, and what if we could start to try to influencing things there? So lastly, the quality of life concerns. There are toxicities to all the treatments reviewed today, and I won't belabor those at this point in time. It might come up with questions in the Q&A, but the first information that I attempt to convey to patients is the following that came out of two papers from a MER cohort study, an epidemiologic study where we survey patients and follow them indefinitely and send out surveys. And the first paper we published in 2018 looked at 3,060 lymphoma patients. So everybody had lymphoma. This included mantle cell. And in that, we reported that higher physical activity among lymphoma patients at diagnosis and in 3 years was significantly associated with the event-free survival at 24 months, lymphoma-specific survival, and overall survival. And these findings were consistent in all subgroups looked at. The second paper was a paper on 2,805 patients who we reported that those that met the American Cancer Society physical activity guidelines for age and sex had a better functional well-being and an overall quality of life. In addition, an increase in physical activity from baseline to the three-year level follow-up was associated with the improvement in physical functional well-being and overall quality of life. And that, as far as data, we can argue that this was patient-reported and not controlled and other issues, but this is, I think, is really fascinating data with interesting patient numbers. And there are all kinds of other advice that we all get and hear about, but I think this is by far away the most important thing. So I hope that both of us have conveyed the message that clinical research has resulted in improved outcomes. That has changed the world. Since I started four decades ago in this field, and I never dreamed we would be here today. The prognosis of mantle cell has changed so much over the last decade, and there is extraordinary hope. I most appreciate your attention, and we look forward to the questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Haberman. And our next speaker is Ms. Nikki Molfetis. And Ms. Molfetis is an oncology social worker and our New Jersey program coordinator here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Molfetis will be discussing Cancer Care's free national programs and services, as well as our Hope Line website, how to get in contact with us. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Molfetis.
Thank you so much, Johnny, and thank you to the other presenters as well. Welcome, everyone. My name is Nikki Molfetis. I am the New Jersey Program Coordinator, as well as an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops like this today, publications, and limited financial assistance. There are many aspects of a cancer diagnosis that may be addressed throughout psychosocial supportive services, whether it's making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, clinical trials, fertility options, and communication with one's medical team are important topics that can be discussed with an oncology social worker. Individuals diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma may choose to supplement their existing social networks by choosing to join a support group or engaging in counseling services. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer supportive services. Being a member in a support group can offer the opportunity to connect with others who are going through a similar situation, obtain information, and provide support. Our online support groups take place on a password-protected website and are moderated by licensed oncology social workers who can offer further support and guidance. You can also register for an online support group through our website at cancercare.org. We also offer resource navigation. This service is offered nationally to patients, post-treatment survivors, and caregivers affected by cancer. It's a short-term, strengths-based approach to case management where the social worker will work with the client in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout their treatment. Please note that if you are encountering these hardships, there are organizations out there to help you. As mentioned earlier, Cancer Care offers our resource navigation as well as limited financial assistance. If you're navigating any practical or financial concerns, I encourage you to call our national Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673 to speak to one of our oncology social workers. We are here to offer you support throughout this experience and are looking forward to speaking with you soon. It has been such a pleasure being part of this program. I will now turn it back to you, Ms. Nazarian. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much, Ms. Molfetis. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay. So our first question here is for Ms. Malfettis. What tips or advice can you offer for stress during doctor's appointments, especially when I follow up after my lab work? I'm always concerned about my numbers going up.
Yeah, thank you so much for this question. I think it's a great question because we hear it a lot. My first tip and advice would be to give yourself some grace and recognize that anxiety around doctor's appointments, lab work is very common. Many people are worried about their numbers changing or, especially when they're closely monitoring their health. I think one helpful approach is to focus on preparation rather than fear. Very much easier said than done. But writing down questions, symptoms, or concerns before the appointment can help individuals feel more organized, empowered during the conversations with the medical team. Also remind yourself of what you can and can't control. We can only control so much, and reminding yourself that we don't have control over lab results, outcomes, things like that. So really focusing on what we can control. It can also help to practice stress reduction techniques before and during appointments. This could be deep breathing, mindfulness, positive self-talk, and reminding yourself that follow-up visits are intended to support your health and guide your treatment. I do encourage open communication with your healthcare team, letting them know that, you're having this anxiety surrounding the results. And then lastly, I would just recommend planning something enjoyable for yourself, whether it's after the doctor's appointment or, after you are receiving those results, something to look forward to. But again, this is all easier said than done. Thanks.
Great. Thank you
like
so much.
If it'd be okay.
Yeah.
This is, and patients who are seeing me over 20 years, it's normal. And I think that to me, the best is some of the better advice I think I've been able to give to patients. And I totally believe in everything that was just conveyed. But remember that it's not abnormal.
Mm-hmm. I might chime in as well and just support everything that was said. And I don't know if I'm on mic here, but also ask my patients, especially when you get to know patients over the years, is how do they, some folks will look at their labs and scans before they see me. Some want me to just, they don't look at it and they want me to tell them first thing when we walk in the room, okay, the labs are fine or the labs are not. And certainly if the labs are fine, I usually just try to clear the air and say, everything's fine. And then the blood pressure goes down. But I really try to, I think patients can also say, hey, I don't look at the stuff beforehand. So just so you know, I don't know what the results are. Or I want you to tell me as soon as you walk in the room, or maybe tell me later. So I think there can be a dialogue about how to make the results best received.
Great. Thank you all so much. Another question here for Dr. Gopal. How is mantle cell lymphoma different from lymphocytic leukemia?
Good question. They can be confused with each other sometimes under the microscope, and especially in the leukemic variant. So I'm assuming you're talking about chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So CLL tends to be much more blood-based. It has different kind of mutations in molecular markers, though sometimes the TP53 can overlap between the two. Mantle cell tends to have this cyclin D1 and SOX11, which is less common in CLL. And our approaches with mantle cell lymphoma, though overlapping with CLL, are not exactly the same. Similarly, CLL tends to have much more of an indolent course. I mean, there can be some tough behaving chronic lymphocytic leukemias, but it tends to have a more slowly progressive course, and for those that we observe, folks can be observed for much longer periods of time typically than mantle cell lymphoma.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Gopal. Good question here for Dr. Haberman. How do you find the best clinical trial for you?
It's a complicated answer and a wonderful question. I think number one, it depends upon who you're seeing and where you're being seen. So what trial would be open at that institution? By far and away, I think influences. You can get out to different websites. Cancer Care has information, LRF has information, NIH has information, and NCI. But for the most part, what really I think happens is it's which institution you go to. And what they might have available. For those involved in community practices, there are community practices that have very active clinical trial portfolios, both industry and in the National Cooperative Oncology Study Group system. Those are kind of the ways of, I'll ask Ajay to probably be more articulate.
Well, I'm not sure I'll be more articulate, but I appreciate the confidence. Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, you know, having really an open discussion with your physician, if there, you know, there might be some very interesting trials, but the relative benefit of if you had to travel thousands of miles to get a trial, that it would probably depend on your individual situation. In terms of how many other options are available. I am completely supportive of people who want to take part in clinical trials, but I think one obviously has to make a personal decision about if the trial is not available there, is it that different or that much beneficial to kind of uproot your life and move to another city to receive something that might be similar? And I don't want to discourage anyone from participating, but I also don't feel like we should twist folks' arms to travel for a trial that might not be that different than what they could get close to home.
I try to take the same pragmatic or practical approach. And, you know, not many years ago, we didn't have a lot of options up front. Now the options we have that are FDA approved or approved on the NCCN guidelines are really quite remarkable. But for those who are interested and who have the wherewithal and the family support to travel, I see patients from significant distances because of that dedication.
Yeah, and I will say many clinical trials will cover travel and lodging, so that can be a help for those that do wish to travel for trials.
And some of these, especially when in the relapse refractory setting, you get into options that might be really very much more interesting and a mm-hmm. real potential opportunity.
Yeah.
So those I try to, I've learned not to be ultra enthusiastic, but I also learned to be practical too. And if I really think that that's a really good treatment option, and I've lived through some of this time period when that's what's happened. So when the BTK inhibitors came out and so forth, things changed, and not everybody had those.
I also counsel patients, I agree 100% with what you're saying, Tom. I also counsel patients that sometimes folks will say, well, I'll just wait till I've used up everything that you can give me or that one can get locally before I think about a clinical trial. And I try to explain that, you know, clinical trials have certain parameters such as, you know, all the organs have to be functioning fine and the blood count's reasonable and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, the off-the-shelf stuff that's approved, we can adjust the doses and attenuate things if we need it, and you can still get that regardless of your organ function. So it's a misunderstanding to think you want to use up everything and then you'll be getting a clinical trial because you might not meet eligibility criteria for a trial. So it's good to think about that early in the relapsed refractory setting while one is still eligible for those trials.
Okay. Great. Thank you both so much. Thank you for answering that. We have another question here for for Dr. Gopal. Can you comment on your thoughts / history regarding refractory second-line therapy trials with zanubrutinib combined with sonrotoclax, which was just recently FDA approved?
No, great question. And I think as Dr. Haberman had mentioned, we're all excited that we have the opportunity to prescribe sonrotoclax as needed for our patients. So, you know, I think the algorithm that Dr. Haberman outlined is very similar to what we have in terms of relapsed or refractory mantle cell lymphoma. So those that have longer initial remission durations have not been refractory to BTK inhibitors, and we may offer a BTK inhibitor as something that one can try to get the most mileage out of. Those that have higher risk disease, we usually will try to get good disease control, and this is where a drug like sonrotoclax may come into play to try to get better disease control by adding a drug like sonrotoclax or other approaches and get people to CAR T therapy. I think for the individual question of whether I would do, I'm not sure if the question was, if I have recurrent mantle cell lymphoma, should I just get zanubrutinib or should I get zanubrutinib plus sonrotoclax? It's a little bit of an open question. At this point, you'll probably get a deeper and longer remission with the combination, but the bigger question is whether that will be of benefit in the long run versus sequential therapy, and it probably is an individualized decision based on the, you know, risk of the mantle cell lymphoma at hand.
I think the sonrotoclax clinical trial, the BCL-2 inhibitor, that's new data, and we're going to need to learn more about it. Interestingly, 10% of patients on that study had pneumonia. Now, that depends upon how active COVID was and a number of other issues when patients were enrolled. And the overall response rate is in the 50% range. And so I think the combination therapy approach, and will likely be through a clinical trial at this point in time, is going to be really important to understand where this is going to play, how it's going to play out. It's one of those things where we finally have a BCL-2 inhibitor that looks very interesting in mantle cell. Now it's going to be the trials to help sort out where it's going to play out.
Great. Thank you both again. So a question here for Dr. Haberman. You'd mentioned physical activity for improving quality of life. What recommendations or advice do you have for staying active, especially when dealing with fatigue?
I cover this question on most patients that I see, and mm-hmm. what I try to describe this is, you have a new job, you need to exercise and work out very regularly, and if you're tired and fatigued, then you need to take a nap during the day, take a power nap, and the fatigue cannot be a reason not to really try to increase your activity. But when you start chemotherapy, when I start patients on chemotherapy, whether it be initial therapy or in the relapse refractory setting, I try to impress upon them that for instance, if you're, I'll just go back to the bendamustine rituximab, which we have used in this disease. You get six treatments. By the fifth and sixth treatment, you're really fatigued. But I say, if you work out, if you exercise, and if you can get to the point to meet the American Cancer Society recommendations, you not only have those better outcomes that I described, but you have less fatigue, not more. And secondly, you get through all of that fatigue a lot better, whereas with many regimens, you're fatigued at the first 9 months, whatever things I just talked about, whether you get a CAR T, whether you get bispecific, whether you get other agents. And so I really, really stress the importance of just because you're fatigued doesn't mean you can't be active and really, really increase, you know, work on your physical activity.
Thank you so much, Dr. Haberman. And I have a question here for Dr. Gopal. How is the Ki-67 determined?
Good question. So this is determined by basically taking a section of the mantle cell lymphoma lymph node or potentially bone marrow or anywhere else we've found mantle cell lymphoma and using a specific stain that shows which cells are dividing. And then you kind of just count up the number of cells that are dividing versus those that are not dividing, the ones that stain positive for this marker. It is a bit, you know, imprecise. There have been studies using automated scoring systems rather than an individual eye of a hematopathologist. So I think we don't get bent out of shape of a few percentages points different from biopsy to biopsy. But generally, it's done in most places in a manual way by counting up cells and seeing what percentage are actively dividing.
And I've run an international tumor board in the last 12 years, but when we look at the slides of these, it's harder to count than we want to think. And secondly, others, we actually in the LEO Consortium reported that maybe 50% would be a better cutoff, but it stays at 30%. I think Ajay's point is really important. If you get a report of, you know, 10% is different than 30, but 27 and 30 or 33 and 30, that starts to get, you know, that's in the eyes of the beholder.
Great. Thank you both so much again. And now I want to ask our speakers to provide takeaways to conclude. So we'll start with Dr. Gopal, then Dr. Haberman, and then Ms. Mulfetis. So I'll start with Dr. Gopal.
Great. First, just a quick thanks again for the opportunity to speak, and really just to emphasize that this is a very exciting, promising time for mantle cell lymphoma and how the outcomes have dramatically improved. We know that from the patients that we care for now, as well as large data sets that Dr. Haberman was quoting. And it makes for complicated decision making, so important to really have these long conversations with your physician to make sure you're on the right track with so many choices. And really just encourage folks to consider as appropriate participating in clinical trials so we can continue to build on the gains that we've made over the last decade plus.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Gopal and Dr. Haberman.
If we haven't provided you hope today, I don't know how we could have done differently. When I started, the median survival was 3 years in this disease, which meant half the patients died of this disease. So what's happened over especially the last decade is just phenomenal. But the complexity, as we've just put forth, and there's no other way to present this than the way I think we just did, is phenomenal. So do what you can to figure out where you are in your disease and be very comfortable with the team treating you and managing you. And if not, then try to reach out to other institutions and other directions. And any opportunity to participate in clinical research will not necessarily benefit you, but will benefit everyone over time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Haberman. And Ms. Mulfetis?
Yeah, thank you so much. I agree with what everyone has said. I think my takeaway was that it's clear that there's been a lot of progress and improvement within treatment options and outcomes. Normalizing the feelings that come with it, feeling your feelings that come with it, but also recognizing that comfortability like that was mentioned with your medical team and communicating this with them and knowing that you're not alone. You know, there's a lot of supports out there. Your medical team is a support and there's other organizations with supportive services as well.
Thank you so much, Ms. Mulfetis. And I just want to take a moment to thank our speakers today. We had a wonderful panel for this workshop. We haven't done this program in quite some time, so I just want to echo what everyone said today, that it's a very hopeful and exciting time. This seems to be a lot of change in the past decade or so. So again, thank you to all of our wonderful speakers today. Now, I do want to say a few words for those of you who asked questions. You didn't have your question answered, you had a question that you were typing in queue, I would like you to go back to your healthcare team and then ask them your questions. Please remember that you've learned a great deal from today's program. We covered a lot. So please take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your questions again and again. And lastly, I don't want anyone to leave this workshop feeling as if they are alone, because you are not alone. You have a community of support here at Cancer Care. We are here for you. And I want to say I appreciate everyone's participation today. I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.